Chapter 17. Psychoarchaeology. Ghoul. The bark of the demon. Gideon's message to me proved that he already knew the name Kanyar the Sharp, but as we talked, I discovered he knew very little besides the name. Nail and I tracked the Janissaries after they fled Messina in an effort to discover who had hired them. It was well hidden. The Vessarine take great pains to protect the identity of their clients. There were false trails, payments from bogus accounts and via holding companies. But we wormed it out eventually. Kanyar the Sharp. Which meant what to you? Nothing. Except that he was the individual who had ordered the systematic destruction of your operation, and that his name featured prominently in a number of the Farseer's visions. We believe Kanyar and the man-machine from the climactic revelation are one and the same. Kanyar the Sharp is Pontius Glore, I said. He was astonished and excited. The revelations had said nothing of Glore. The Kanyar guys had masked his true identity from the Eldar. Why target you? He asked. Self-preservation. I am one of the few people who knows he still exists. In fact, I'm sorry to say, he exists because of me. He was also searching for something that he believes I possess. Like what? I had no choice but to tell him everything. My dealings with Glore, Marla Tare, the Malus Codicium. You weren't joking when you said you weren't the Puritan I once knew, he said. Are you shocked? No, Gregor, I'm not. I believe radicalism is inevitable. We all become radicals eventually, as we appreciate that we must know our enemy in order to defeat him. The real dangers come from extreme Puritans. Puritanism is fueled by ignorance, and ignorance is the greatest peril of all. That's not to suggest the path of the radical is easy. Eventually, even the most careful and responsible radical will be overwhelmed by the warp. The real judge of character is what good a man can do for the Imperium before he is drawn too far. There is one other thing. In the mind of his daughter, there was an image of a desiccated world that closely matches the one you described from the Eldar revelations. There was a name connected with it. Ghoul. Let me investigate that further, he said, and turned his force chair back down the walkway towards the camp. Ravana had brought me to that remote jungle world because Promedy had featured in another of the Eldar visions. Kanyar the Sharp had been there recently, perhaps as little as 6 weeks before. Ravana intended to find out why. Ravana's field team numbered about 10 individuals, several technicians, 6 astropaths, and an archaeologist called Kenza, the grey-haired man I had seen earlier. But there are no ruins on Promedy, I remarked shortly after I had been introduced to him.
Not any more, sir, he agreed. But there is compelling theory that Promedy was once one of several worlds inhabited by an ancient culture.
How ancient? He glanced at me nervously.
Pre-dawn, he said.
A culture from before the rise of man. That was breathtaking. So this compelling theory, I pressed. This comes from the Eldar. He didn't want to answer, but my rank gave him little option.
Yes, sir. But this culture predates even them, and was quite dead long before even they came to the stars.
Ravana's technicians had spent their time, since reaching Promedy, conducting a survey with the assistance of the astropaths. They had studied the surface and atmosphere of the planet for signs of Kanyar's visit, looking for traces of landing sites, the residual pollution of vehicle exhausts, the echoes of human minds. They were certain now that the campsite on the bayou was close to the place where Kanyar made planetfall. Now the astropaths were preparing for an auto-seance on a scale greater than any I had ever attempted. Gideon called me to the force tent.
Ghoul is the name of a planet, he said.
The dead world and the vision?
Quite probably.
And where is it?
We don't know.
Who's we? Where did this information come from? He sighed.
Lord Seer, he called.
One of the inner screens drew aside, and a slim, very tall figure in a long hooded robe stepped through from the privacy of the inner rooms. The robe was made of a gleaming blue material that flashed like shot silk, but seemed heavier and more fluid. There was a strange, unpleasantly sweet scent, like burnt sugar. I knew that hood would never be drawn back in my presence. I was not fit to see the face beneath.
This is Eisenhorn,
the figure said. It wasn't a question. The words flowed melodically with a strange cadence that no human could ever approximate. Who am I addressing? I said.
The book is in his coat,
the figure said to Ravenor, ignoring me.
An insult that he carries it so casually.
Gregor?
I took the Malus Caelicium from my pocket. The figure made a warning gesture with its gloved right hand. It's an insult that your friend will have to tolerate, I'm afraid, I said. This isn't leaving my person.
It has contaminated him. It smoulders in his blood. It has yoked him to demons.
And more beside, no doubt, I countered. But take one look into my mind and tell me I'm not dedicated to the salvation of all of us. I dropped my psi shield provocatively, but though I could sense the Eldar's temptation to look, he did not touch my mind.
Ravenor vouches for you,
the hooded figure said after a moment.
I will content myself with that. Do not come any closer.
So what do I call you?
You won't have any need to,
the Eldar replied bluntly. Please, Gideon cut in. He was clearly very uncomfortable. Gregor, you may refer to my guest as Lord Seer. My lord, perhaps you could tell Gregor about Ghoul.
In the first days, a race came from the Maelstrom and raised settlements in this space. 7 worlds they made, and the greatest of these was Ghoul. Then they were overturned and left no trace behind.
From the Maelstrom? From the warp? You mean a demon race? The Lord Seer said nothing. Are you saying demons once colonized 7 worlds in our reality?
They fled a war. Their king was dead, and they carried his body for burial. On his tomb, they raised the first city, and then made 6 worlds around it, to honor his rest forever.
Ghoul is the tomb of a demon king. There was no response. What? Are you just going to answer every other question? Is Ghoul the tomb world? Is that what Glor is after? The tomb of a demon?
I have not seen the answer,
said the Eldar. Then take a wild guess.
The demon king is dead. Kanyar cannot hope to raise him.
Unless he has the Malus Caelicium, I said.
Not even then.
So what then? I snapped. Traditionally, Gideon put in. In human culture, anyway, a king is buried with great treasures and artifacts beside him. So there's something in this tomb. Something so valuable that the Malus Caelicium is just a key to get it. Where is Ghoul?
We don't know, said Ravenor.
Does Glor know?
I think that's why he was here.
The Eldar withdrew, and I was glad to be out of his presence. I found it hard to know how Ravenor tolerated him. Outside, the final preparations were being made. All of Ravenor's people, except Kenza and the 6 astropaths, were withdrawing to his ship. Nail and Kara were going to the SN.
A message from Maxilla, Nail said to me. You've had a communique from Fischig.
Fischig? Really?
It seems he's changed his mind, that he regrets his clash with you and wants to come back.
I think it's too late for that, Harlan. Nail shrugged.
Cut him some slack, I say, boss. You know how hardline he is. He's had time to think about things, get his head around stuff. Let him come back. From what Gideon's been saying, we could probably use him.
No. Later, maybe. Not now. I don't think I can trust him.
He probably thinks the same thing about you,
grinned Nail.
Joke,
he added, raising his hands to pacify me.
Good luck,
he finished, then walked off to the shuttle where Kara Swoll was waiting. It was just dawn. Before their departure, the technicians had extended the antigrav walkways to form a circular path across the bayou 50 meters in diameter. The astropaths spread out around the suspended walkways under the thick, steaming vegetation. I stood with Gideon and Kenza on one of the central sections. The evenly spaced astropaths began to murmur as they sank into their trances and the air became charged with psychopathic energy. Instead of focusing on a single object, as Yekud Vance and I had done with Midas's jacket, the astropaths were opening the entire area up, conjuring its psychic traces. A cold blue glow began to spread around us, quite at odds with the light of the rising sun. Things became filmy and misty.
"I see something," Kenza said.
So did I. Shapes, like clouds, writhing and forming above the water at the center of the circle. Nothing distinct. I felt Ravener reach out with his mind and fine-tune the coherence of the image. Just standing there beside him, I could feel how strong his mind had grown. My old pupil was frighteningly powerful. Suddenly, the image resolved. Three figures wading through the bayou's knee-deep water. One, a massive Ogryn with a blaster cannon, followed in the splashing wake of a sturdy male human dressed in beige combat armor, his face hidden by a rebreather. This human was scanning the area with a handheld Auspex. The third figure was beside him. It was tall, broad, and moved with a strange stiffness, its body partially draped with what looked at first like a cape of feathers. They weren't feathers. They were blades. Tongues of polished, sharpened metal interlaced into an armored garment. Beneath it, I could glimpse a body of burnished chrome, duralloy, and steel. A mechanical humanoid body of marvelous design. The work of Magos Geared Bure, I had no doubt. The late Geared Bure. This was Kanyar the Sharp, the man-machine, the living blade from the Eldar vision. Pontius Glor. I could see his face. It was the face of a beautiful young man with a mane of curled hair, but the hair didn't move, and the expression didn't alter from a curling smirk. It was a mask worked from gold, like the head of a noble gilded statue. I had seen the face before, in old records that showed Pontius Glor in his prime. There was no sound, but Glor said something to his point man. Then he turned and seemed to address someone or something we couldn't see. There was a long pause as they waited, and then the Ogryn shuffled back, as if alarmed by something. The point man set his Auspex to close focus. Glor stood still, as if awestruck for a moment, then clapped his metal hands in delight.
"I can't see what they're doing," Kenza said.
"There's nothing there to see," Gideon snapped in disappointment.
That seemed to be the case. There was a faint visual distortion where the psychic ghost of the location failed to match its real counterpart exactly, but nothing else.
"No," I said suddenly. "I think there is.
Get your astropaths to widen the field of the seance."
"What?" Gideon asked.
"Just do it." With a little effort, Ravener's telepaths managed to increase the diameter of the conjured scene. Almost at once, we were able to make out shadowy figures lurking around the edge.
"Psychers," said Gideon.
"Exactly," I said. "The reason we can't see what he's up to is because he did what we're doing."
"An auto-seance."
"That's right."
"How did you guess, Gregor?"
"Mr. Kenza here said there were no ancient remains on Promedy. Glor has to be looking for the past by other means. But we can't resolve what it is he's seeing."
"Go back,"
said a voice behind us. Silently, the Eldar Seer had joined us on the walkway.
"Go back,"
he said again. It took a few minutes for the astropaths to compose themselves and re-establish the image. Now I could feel the Eldar's mental strength supporting them. We watched as the scene replayed. The three figures approached us just as before. Glor conversed with his point man and then called back to his psychers. The world changed. There was no jungle, no water. Great, smooth cliffs of rock blocked out the sky. Stone columns like giant fir trees towered over us. We were seeing what Glor's psychers had allowed him to see. The surface of Promedy, as it had been eons before the age of man. A cyclopean city of glassy black rock that had long since vanished so completely, only its psychic phantom remained.
"God, Emperor!"
Kenza gasped and collapsed in a faint. It was terrifying. Mesmeric. The scale was so big. We felt like microbes or motes of dust on the streets of an imperial hive. I stared, fascinated. Now when the Ogryn shuffled back in fear and Glor stood awestruck, I could see why. Glor clapped his hands in delight, and the point man began scanning a wide section of the ghostly wall with his Auspex.
"There's an inscription," Ravenna cried.
I leapt off the walkway and waded through the oily water until I was beside the images of Glor and his men.
"We need to get this before it fades," I shouted.
Ravenna flew his chair in over the water to join me. Recording sensors in his chair began to whir and store the images. They were written in a language I had never seen before. It made me sick to look at it. There was no linear form. It simply spiraled and meandered up across the massive wall face, looping and circling. I felt dizzy. Glor was capering and dancing like a lunatic, his machine body lurching and awkward. The light around us began to wink and flicker.
"We're losing it," said Ravenna.
"Probably time we did," I said, stumbling back towards the walkway. The colossal city melted away. Then Glor and his companions vanished, and blue light ebbed away. Ravenna's telepaths were slumped on the walkways, exhausted. The Eldar stood, head bowed. It looked like a chart.
"It was a chart," said the Eldar. "A plan of the Seven Worlds. And it was the location of Ghul."
Pontius Glor knew where he was going. He'd known for some weeks. He might already have arrived. It took Ravenna and the Lord Seer about a day to make sense of the findings. Allowing for precession and sidereal shifts as best they could, considering the vast passage of time involved, they determined that the world known before the time of man as Ghul was in an uncharted system designated 5213X, 3 months outside Imperial space and 20 weeks from our current location. We made preparation to break orbit the following night. Ravenna explained to me that the Eldar had requested to be taken to a secret location en route, where he could access something called a warp tunnel. Ravenna was beholden to him. We agreed to rendezvous at Giganda, 3 weeks short of 5213X, prior to the final leg of our chase.
"Do we inform the Ordos?" Ravenna asked.
"No. What strength they could lend us would be outweighed by problems they'd cause. I will prepare a full documented account of everything we know to be transmitted back in the event that we..."
"We?"
"Fail," I finished. Before we departed, I dared to visit Ravenna's ship, the Hinterlight. I took Crezia and Harlan Nail with me. Medicae and Tribus showed us to the low-lit chamber off the starship's infirmary where Elizabeth lay, inside a softly glowing stasis field. Crezia and Harlan hung back by the hatchway. Elizabeth looked like she was asleep. Her skin was as pale as the snows of the High Atenites.
"Is she alive?"
I asked Antribus.
"Yes, sir.
I mean, without these vital supports, the stasis field."
"If we shut them down, she may remain the way she is. But she might also fade. It is never easy to tell in cases of such significant injury."
"Will she recover?" I asked.
"No,"
he said, caring enough to look me in the eyes.
"Except for some miracle. She will never regain consciousness or mobility."
"So she's dead to us. Has she any quality of life?"
"Who can say, sir? She's not in any pain. I believe she is dreaming an endless, tranquil dream. If you consider that to be cruel, we can disconnect the machines and let nature take its course."
He withdrew. Crezia appeared at my side.
"What are you going to do, Gregor?" she asked.
"I won't turn the machines off. Not yet. My mind's too full of that bastard Glor. I'll make a decision afterwards. If there is an afterwards," I thought. "I'd like you and Nail to stay with her. Look after her. Will you do that?"
"Of course," she said.
I realized this was the first time she'd ever set eyes on Elizabeth Beckwin.
"Really? It's a big thing to ask of you."
"I'm a doctor, and your friend, Gregor. It's not a big thing."
I turned to go.
"She can probably hear you," she said suddenly.
"Do you think so?" Crezia shrugged and smiled.
"I don't know. There's every chance she can. And if she can't, does it matter?"
"Does what matter?"
"Tell her, Gregor. Now, before you go. Tell her, for goodness sake. Do the right thing by one of us, at least."
She left me alone and I sat down beside Elizabeth's cot. And then, though I don't know to this day if she ever heard or understood, I told her all the things I should have told her years before. I said goodbye to Ravener and promised to wait for him at Jaganda. I kissed Crezia goodbye and went to the Hinterlights hangar to cross back to the SN. Nail came to see me off. I shook his hand. "Keep an eye on Gideon," I said. He frowned.
"You don't trust him?"
he asked. "With my life. But I don't trust his friends." As the SN pulled away from Promedy, gathering speed as it headed for the Immaterium translation point Maxilla's navigator had calculated, I went to find Amos. He was in his suite of rooms, puzzling his way through a deep stack of books he'd borrowed from Maxilla's library. "Something else to divert you," I said, handing him a pile of data slates and record tiles. Before we had parted company, Ravener had copied for me everything he had been permitted to copy, including a picked file of the inscription, as his force chair's sensors had recorded it. "Gideon has marked some key passages in his notes to get you up to speed, but the inscription, which is a chart, is what really interests me. Gideon's associate told me what it means, or the part of it that applies to Ghoul, anyway. I'd like to know a little more, in literal terms."
"You want me to decipher an alien text that was long dead before man appeared?"
Put like that, it was a tall order. "There are some other samples of the same script that Ravener obtained from other sites. I don't know, do what you can with it. Anything you can turn up will be useful." The voyage to Jaganda was not the longest I have ever undertaken, but it felt like it. I was fretful and ill at ease, impatient to arrive. My mind would not stop thinking about Glor's head start, or how close the Farseer's nothingness loomed. To fill the time, I meditated and exercised, burrowed my way through Maxilla's library in search of anything pertaining to the Eldar and their legends. Kara worked to get Medea up to fitness, and, after 2 weeks, the three of us were running through demanding combat training each day. Sometimes Alina joined us for the lighter sessions to keep in shape. I was glad I had an untouchable with me, given our destination and Glor's abilities. Except for Elizabeth, who didn't really count under the circumstances, Alina was the last living member of the distaff. I wondered if I would ever recruit and build it again. I wondered if I would even get the chance. During the third week, Amos called me to his suite to discuss his findings so far. I wondered why he hadn't simply told me over dinner. We all met for a meal each evening anyway. He told me he was making progress. The ancient culture which had built Ghoul appeared indirectly in several old sources. It seems that early Imperial explorers had known myths of a dead precursor race from some of their first contacts with Xenos species, though Amos was concerned that some of the references could be to other dead cultures or to species that had migrated or transplanted themselves. One theme emerged. The race of Ghoul were marked as others or outsiders because they had not originated in our galaxy. The name Ghoul itself didn't appear anywhere.
"One minor culture, the Doi of Mitas, have a legend concerning the Zol Zonzoi, demons who ruled once and would return. The word meant warped ones."
A good enough description as any? The Eldar seemed convinced that the culture was a colony of demons from the warp. Not even a race in its own right, more a host, an army, a nation, an exiled demon king and his followers, perhaps.
"There are a few more bits and pieces, not much. I'm getting nowhere with the inscription, though it is extraordinary, and Gideon's footage of that seance most perturbatory. I'd like to borrow your book."
"Your what?"
"Your damned book." I used the adjective advisedly.
"You said you never wanted to see it again," I reminded him.
"I don't, Gregor. It chills me to know it is even on board. But what chills me more is what we're going out there to find. And you've asked me to do a job, and that's the only tool available to me that I haven't used."
I took the Malus Codicium from my pocket. For a moment I couldn't bring myself to pass it to him. "Be careful," I hissed.
"I know the procedures," he said grumpily. "You've had me study prohibited texts before."
"Not like this one." I kept an eye on Amos after that, visiting him regularly and making sure he came to meals. He became tired and short-tempered. I wanted to take the book away from him, but he said he was nearly done. We were a week from Jaganda when he finished his work.
"It's incomplete," he warned, "but the main elements are there.
He seemed even more fatigued than before, and had developed a slight shake on his left side. His suite was a mess of papers and slates, notes and scrawlings, scattered books. In places where he had apparently run out of paper, he had continued his notes on tabletops or even walls. Uber Amos had performed his greatest work of service for me, the hardest task I had ever set him. And it had cost him. It had damaged his health and, I was afraid, his sanity. "The Demon King," he said, spreading out a large sheet of scribbled-on vellum across the litter on his desk. "Who is represented by this glyph here?" He pointed with a palsied finger. "And by this triple formation of symbols here was called Amos?"
"Isaril."
He all but had to spit the word out of his mouth to make the sound. The gilded clock on the table beside his unmade bed chimed twice suddenly, for no reason.
"It keeps doing that," Amos growled crossly.
His finger stabbed another mark on the paper for me to look at, and then traced down a curling line of script. His notes, I realized, had taken the form of the chart itself.
"Here, look. There was a war. The Demon King..."
"Just call him the Demon King."
"The Demon King fought a war of staggering enmity with a rival. The rival's name is not given, but from the marking here, I would guess it was one of what we tentatively understand to be the four primary powers of chaos, although it seems there were only three at that time. I wonder why."
I couldn't answer that. I wondered if the Farseer could.
"The rival is described as a foul sorcerer," Amos continued. "I don't pretend or want to know the hierarchies of the warp, but in simple terms, damn it! Isaril was a lieutenant, a warlord, a prince, whatever you want to call it, who tried to usurp the place of this primary power."
Amos unrolled another crumpled sheet and wiped pencil shavings off it.
"The war lasted 1 billion years, as we would understand it. The Demon King was destroyed by his rival, killed outright. His host fled in terror at this crushing defeat and sought sanctuary in the material universe. Our universe. There they established a capital and 6 kindred colonies. The capital, Ghoul, was built upon the Demon King's mausoleum, which was itself constructed around his bark."
"His bark?"
"I suppose they mean his ship. The word is closer to chariot or galley in literal terms. And I think this may be the key point. The bark was his war machine, the craft that he rode into battle. It is described here, and also here, as being of such power and might that the warped ones who wrote this were themselves staggered by it."
He looked at me.
"The bark of the Demon King, a weapon of inconceivable power that lies entombed in the mausoleum of Ghoul. That prize, so I am told, is what Glor is after."
"Told?" He started, shaking his head.
I'm tired. I meant that's what I've learned from this. My work."
"You said told."
"I did not."
"Distinctly."
"Yes, well, I did. Because I used the wrong word. Learned. That's what I have learned."
I put my hand on his shoulder, reassuringly, but he flinched. "Amos, you've done an extraordinary job with this. I've asked a lot of you."
"Yes, you have."
"Too much."
"I serve you, sir. It is never too much."
"I'll have Maxilla prepare another room for you. You can't sleep in here."
"I'm used to the clutter," he said.
"It's not the clutter I'm worried about." He shuffled away, muttering. "I need to take the book back now," I said.
"It's here somewhere," he said, offhand. "I'll bring it to you later."
"I'll take it now," he glared at me. "Now, please," I repeated. He pulled the Malus Caedicium from under a pile of notes that fluttered onto the carpet and held it out. I took hold, but he would not let go. "Amos." I managed to yank the book away. The clock mischimed again.
"I think you should consider your options, Gregor," he said.
"What do you mean?"
"The powers we face are great. Too great, perhaps. We are woefully under strength. I think we should be stronger."
"How do you propose we do that?"
"Summon the demon host."
"What?" He took off his heavy augmetic eyeglasses and polished the lenses with the corner of his robe. His hands were shaking badly now.
I didn't approve before, Honduras. But I think I grasp things a little better now. I understand the choices you've made, the rules you've bent. All for the good, and I apologize for ever doubting you. With the demon host, we might stand a chance. Summon it here.
How? He became agitated with me.
Like you did on Mikwal.
That was sheer desperation, I reproved.
We're desperate now.
And we have no host to summon it into.
You didn't then.
And it nearly killed us with its raw power before I could trap it.
Then use one of Maxilla's astropaths as a host.
I stared at him levelly. I won't kill a man just to provide a host.
You did on Mikwal,
he hissed softly.
What did you say?
You did on Mikwal. Vervuk wasn't dead. You sacrificed him for the good of us all. Why would you flinch from doing it again?
Why would I do again something I wish had never happened?
Are we not playing for the highest stakes? One life, sir. What is that compared to the millions that may die if Glor succeeds? Summon the demon host. Summon Cherubael to help us.
I walked slowly to the door. Get some rest, I said with forced lightness. You'll feel better for it. You'll have changed your mind.
Whatever,
he said, turning away dismissively. He was entirely unprepared for the will I unleashed at him.
What did it say to you?
I commanded. Amos cried out and his legs gave way. He crashed to the deck and half overturned a table in his efforts to stay upright. His papers avalanched onto the floor.
It told you, didn't it? It told you. You damn fool, Uber, what did you do?
I couldn't crack the code, he wailed. The language was beyond me. But there was so much more in that book. That beautiful book. I realized I could do more.
You spoke to the demon host.
No.
Then how else would you know its name? Because I sure as hell never told you.
He shrieked out and staggered back to his feet, his face locked in a grimace of pain and shame and fear.
It was there, in the pages,
he cried.
Close, like a whisper in my ear. So soft. It said it could help. It said it would tell me everything I needed if I could only arrange its release.
Oh, God, Emperor, everything you've told me today you learned from that bastard thing, Cherubael.
It was true,
he screamed.
True! Israel! Israel!
The clock began to chime furiously. A glass pitcher and three tumblers on the bureau shattered. One lens of Amos's eyeglasses cracked clean across. He collapsed onto the floor. I summoned servitors and took him to the sick bay. For safety, we locked him in an isolation bay. His safety, and ours. The damn clock was still chiming when I went back to his room to burn the papers.